Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Once part of the ATA tribe, you'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one Leslie Ide. Leslie became a veterinarian in 2006 after graduating from Colorado State University's College of Veterinary School and Biomedical Sciences. She planned on pursuing a residency in behavior medicine after completing a rotating internship in small animal medicine in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Instead, though, her interest in dog sports took over, and she continued her education by becoming certified in canine rehabilitation through the Canine Rehab Institute with a focus in sports medicine. Rehabilitation and sports medicine combine her love of behavior and love for all things dog sports. Her research interests include canine exercise, physiology, and sports performance. Whilst working in veterinary rehabilitation and sports medicine, Leslie continues to compete in dog agility. She has competed in agility for the past 17 years with Australian Shepherds and Border Collies. Recently, she placed third in the 22-inch speed stakes class at the US Open with her dog Stig. She currently practices at Sound Veterinary Rehabilitation Center in Seattle and is a recent winner of an AARV grant for rehab and sports medicine residents for investigating how exercise affects flyball performance. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Leslie to the show today, all the way from Seattle. Leslie, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here today.
Yeah, thrilled to have you on the show. We haven't actually had a significant number of fully qualified veterinarians on the show, unfortunately. So excited to add you to that small but growing list.
Awesome. And I hope it grows more because I think it really should.
Yeah, absolutely. But we of course, appreciate the intense pressures on people in your industry from numerous different areas. So just really thrilled that you can be a ripple that leads to that thing that you said you hope happens. Hey, let's go back though, Leslie. Let's dive straight into the first question. Can you take the listeners on a journey to where you first learned about your love for dog training, for positive reinforcement, and share some stories from your early career?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I have a bit of a unique story in that as a veterinarian, I don't have the typical story of being that, you know, little kid who was just like, I'm going to be a vet. I love animals, you know, from the time they're 5 years old. My first passion, I would say, was swimming, and my life revolved around swimming. And then my swimming career was over in my last year of undergrad at university. And the first thing I did was go out and buy a puppy because I knew I needed something else. And I can't even say why I knew it, but I did. I got a puppy, and my goals were that it was going to be the best trained dog there ever was. And I really, really wanted to do agility with it. So I got an Australian Shepherd. And as soon as I could, I started taking training classes. And I will say at that time, it was a very traditional training methods. But that was my start in dog training and even my start in agility. And I was very lucky. And I'd say this is a bit unique because I wouldn't say most veterinarians get this opportunity. But when I went to vet school, one of my classmates had a master's in animal behavior and was very passionate about positive reinforcement dog training and teaching her classmates about it. And so she also took that passion to really pushing the curriculum for the veterinary students. And so we had electives in animal behavior that weren't part of the traditional veterinary curriculum. We had a behavior club that was very strongly focused on positive reinforcement. And so that's really where I first got exposed to it and was like blown away that there's this whole other way to train dogs, and it's so much happier and a lot more fun than kind of what I had been doing, and made agility a lot more fun too. And so that's where I really built my need for doing things a better way, a more positive way, a happier way for both the animal and the person working with the animal. I also at that time had a dog with some behavior problems. So that was kind of the mix of those two things ignited my passion for really thinking that I was going to become a veterinary behaviorist. And that was the reason why I was at veterinary school. You know, things changed, but that's really how I got started with that path.
Awesome, man. Potentially a first on the ATA podcast, as we haven't had someone who came from a swimming background into dog training before. Then I'm really curious about, you said you went and got a puppy then, you don't know why, but obviously we're grateful that you did. And I'm just like, obviously you've got your whole life before that as a swimmer, and to be a swimmer, you know, requires something that you would have had in medical school, I'm sure. And vet medical school is persistence and determination, hard work, getting up early. Is there anything that you brought as a swimmer? Because we haven't had a swimmer before, so I have to ask this question. Is there anything you brought from your experience being a swimmer that you think has given you has helped you in your dog career?
Well, I mean, definitely, you know, it helps you getting through school because you learn a lot about time management, managing school around all the time you have to spend working out in the pool and whatnot. But I'd say of anything, I think the swimming really developed my love of competition, which does help in school as well, striving to be the best at something. But it also carried over to the dog training aspect. And I think that's really why I needed to find a dog sport. Like, I wasn't just going to be a dog owner. I was going to be someone that competed with my dog and, you know, could really strive to be the best at something. Hence kind of why I was like, I'm going to have the best trained dog. Well, that kind of carried over to, that means I'm going to do really well in agility.
I see. So it kind of like you had to fill that space in your life for that competitive part of you that you have, and you did that through your relationship with your dog and doing those activities together. That's pretty cool. So you said you nearly filled the criteria for how to become a successful professional dog trainer. That is, you first start with traditional techniques, then you get a dog with behavior challenges, and then the third thing is, and then you go and read Karen Pryor's Don't Shoot the Dog. I'm sure that was in there somewhere.
Yes, that was, I believe, a required reading in the veterinary behavior elective that I took my freshman year of veterinary school. If it wasn't, I'm sure someone recommended I read it. So I do still have it on my bookshelf. It was read during veterinary school and started a little bit of my journey. I will actually say my first introduction to behavior was a veterinarian, so it was Dr. Nicholas Dodman, and reading his book was why, like, what inspired me to be a veterinary behaviorist.
Oh, cool. I haven't heard that name before. So he's a vet behaviorist, did you say?
Yes, he's a vet behaviorist at Tufts University, and he was kind of the father of pharmacology. So he was really brought in the use of medications in the veterinary behavior realm.
Awesome. And so you got your puppy, you're at university, you generalized your competitive nature over to your dog and dog sports. And then you said you had a dog with behavior issues. Can you share any stories from what you learned from this dog? Was it an Australian Shepherd, did you say?
Yes. So my dog with behavior issues was actually my second dog, Tundra, and she was my first agility dog, and really went to really, really high levels in agility. So it's, again, kind of a unique story that my first agility dog was very competitive and one of the top Australian Shepherds in the country. She had dog issues, basically, dog aggression. And so not great for competing at agility trials, where there's a lot of dogs running around, and she needs to stay focused on me and stay focused on doing her job. And she did. She was a dog that I was doing the traditional training with because she was very early. And one of the solutions that they gave me was putting an electronic shock collar on her to keep her from going after other dogs. And luckily, again, when I went to vet school and was presented with other options, I found other ways to help her. And one of the biggest people that came into my life at that time was Patricia McConnell. And I actually attended some of her workshops, and she helped me develop a plan to help Tundra be better around other dogs and focus on me more.
Not a bad mentor to find at all. So you were going to go to do a rotating internship in small animal medicine in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So it must have been a pretty big decision to not do that, because I'm sure there's lots of considerations that went through your mind, one of them being finances. And, you know, that must have been a pretty, I imagine it must have been a pretty big decision.
Yeah, so I did actually end up doing the internship. The plan was after the internship to immediately go into a behavior residency to get board certified and be able to call myself a veterinary behaviorist. During the internship was when I had all those things that you mentioned, the financial issues, and kind of came to the realization that this may not be the best career path, or maybe I need to put it on hold for a little bit. There was one veterinary behaviorist in the entire state of New Mexico, and even though he had done all the schooling and was, board certified, he basically only practiced 1 or 2 days a week in veterinary behavior medicine, and the other days of the week had to be just general practice. So even though he was a specialist, he maybe 50% of his work time was spent doing what he was passionate about. And I didn't want that to happen to me. I wanted to, go all in if I was going to do it. And so I had some questions. I went through the application process and basically at the last minute was like, no, I have to put this on hold. I need to get experience the real world a little bit more. And actually at that point, one of my mentors, the surgeon I was working with, was like, hey, there's this new up and coming field of sports medicine, and you already do dog sports, so you already know a lot of what you need to know for this. So maybe look into that. And he really gave me the push to look into this new field.
And I'm sure it still wasn't an easy road forward to kind of be part of that pioneering group there.
Yeah, it was a bit of an unknown because at that time it was in its infancy. So basically they were establishing a board certification process and there weren't any what we would call traditional residencies, meaning there weren't any programs at the universities. It was kind of people were doing self-study and figuring it out and grandfathering into a board certification. So it does make it hard in that it's not like one of those established specializations like surgery or internal medicine. So it's still kind of a little bit like, you know, the step kid in the corner that maybe we'll let them participate, but it's fun. And it definitely fit my loves of dog or animal veterinary medicine. You know, it has a huge component of behavior in it. And then also we get to do sports. So it's a lot of fun.
So can you unpack that a little bit more when you say it has a huge component of behavior in it, but you also get to do sports? Like, can you give us, like, if I was to apply for a job, obviously I wouldn't get it as a sports medicine professional. Like, what would be my job description?
So in the veterinary clinic, I will say mostly what you're doing is rehabilitation, which is like human physical therapy or physiotherapy. And so we're taking dogs or any animal, really, we're returning them from injury or from surgery. And a lot of it is modalities like ultrasound or neuromuscular electrical stimulation, hydrotherapy in the underwater treadmill. But a lot of it, a big component, is actually therapeutic exercise. And that's where the behavior part comes in, is that we have to teach the dogs to do these exercises and do them appropriately. And then we also have to teach their owners how to do those exercises at home. So that's, I think, the most obvious place where we use behavior and dog training. But then there's also the component of having them be comfortable in the clinic for these treatment sessions. So I will say I use a lot of other kind of methods, like, you know, both classical conditioning of just building a positive emotional response for being in the clinic. We do a lot of work when we introduce them to the underwater treadmill, of giving them choice and letting them go in the treadmill and then out of the treadmill if they want, and really trying to build a positive response to it so that they want to be a part of the therapy. And so a lot of what I do as the veterinarian is I have to also teach all my staff how to do that and how to read the dog's body language and know how to respond to that appropriately, and always trying to keep things positive and force-free, for kind of lack of a better term.
And are your clients, they're sport professionals, or they are pet dog owners?
So a lot of, in the clinic, a lot of it is pet dog owners that, you know, they've had an injury or had to have surgery from like tearing a cruciate. I am trying to build up my sports clients because that's really what I want to focus on and what I want to do. But probably about now, it's maybe 25% of my clientele are really the sports people that are coming to me because they noticed their dogs were a little off or a little slow at the last competition, or they weren't turning quite as tight as they had been. And that's really fun for me because I get to use my diagnostic skills trying to find, okay, where is this little problem that, you know, only the owner is noticing, but, you know, you take them to the orthopedic surgeon and they're like, they're fine. There's nothing wrong. Nothing's broken. And I have to try and figure out what the little thing is off and how to help fix it, but then also how to prevent it from happening again.
It's a pretty unique skill set, and I'm assuming that, like, you know, the people that listen to this podcast work with pet dog owners in their homes, and they're probably skilled animal professionals that listen to this podcast, a large section of them. Not that there's people that aren't as experienced or haven't been learning about positive reinforcement for as long, because they also listen to the podcast. But I know that once you develop your name in an area, sometimes people can then start to send you all of the aggression cases and all of the reactive cases, and you're like, oh my God, you know, and it can become quite stressful and even unrewarding in some situations. So your stuff sounds like fun, firstly. just want to acknowledge it. But so you're dealing with a completely different client base, and I would say a lot of people are used to. Do you find that owners are kind of, they understand what's required to help their dog after surgery, or are they just, have they heard of positive reinforcement before, or do they follow this protocol as you set for them?
Right. So one of the nice things that I get to do, because they're not approaching it as dog training, is I kind of get to sneak it in without having to explain what I'm doing or say, okay, we're going to do positive reinforcement training. We just basically say, we tell them, this is how we do things in our clinic. And that's, you know, kind of no questions asked. And the really great thing that I love is that when people who either don't have a lot of knowledge of dog training, or were maybe taught to teach their dogs in a different manner, see how well their dogs respond to it, and they take it home and they spread the word, and they're like, I didn't know you could do all these things, and my dog just loves it. It's really great to see that and to hear that kind of feedback. Besides the, you know, just making their dogs better, that's always rewarding as well. But I especially enjoy when they tell me they've learned a whole new way to train their dog.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you made the decision to follow the sports medicine pathway. And how has the industry grown since that time? And where did your career take you? Was there any other significant, poignant moments in your career?
Yeah, so I would say rehab and sports medicine is exploding, at least in the States for sure, but I think all over the world, people are recognizing the importance of it. We no longer want to accept, and dog owners don't want to accept the recommendation to put their dogs in a crate for 8 weeks after surgery. They say, you know, that wouldn't happen in human medicine. You know, if someone goes and has knee surgery, a person has knee surgery, they are being told, you know, within 24, 48 hours to get up and start moving and start doing exercise. And people now expect the same thing for their pets. And so it's really taking off. And every day I'm seeing things on social media, requests of like, I can't find anyone close to me. I have to drive, you know, 5 hours to find the nearest rehab sports medicine vet. Why aren't there more? So, you know, it's still not enough of us. We need more, but it's really growing. And for me, it's I think the nice thing is it helps me also continue to be passionate about the sport I compete in. So that's, you know, I can kind of claim competing as research and, you know, combine the two things together. So that's probably the best thing that's happened with it for me.
And so you said that there was non-traditional electives at your school about behavior. So then anyone listening to this, veterinarian potentially, I don't know what the motivation of other people are to go, or resources are, I should say, sorry, more relevant, to get to where you are with your qualifications and career. But how does one become a sports medicine vet, and when they go to do the qualifications required, is positive reinforcement part of that now?
Yeah, good question. So it's still so there's a couple of different levels. You know, the first thing you have to do is become a veterinarian. And then past that, there's now a couple certification programs. And so, like you mentioned in my bio, I went through the Canine Rehab Institute to get my initial certification. And really, really, once you're a veterinarian, you can do anything within the scope of veterinary medicine. So you can do surgery, you can do internal medicine. As you specialize, as you become board certified, then you get to say, I specialize in surgery or I specialize in internal medicine. I technically, even though I have a certificate from the Canine Rehab Institute and all I do in my practice is rehabilitation and sports medicine, I still can't technically say I specialize in rehab and sports medicine until I pass my board certification. And that's what I'm working on right now. So as we speak, there are two pathways to getting your board certification. You can get either in the university, go through a residency, a traditional residency program, or you can do what's called a non-traditional practice pathway. So meaning you're out in the real world, you're practicing, but you're still working on all the requirements to get your residency. And that's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, awesome. And then, so what kind of requirements that so like someone else in your shoes, like are they, because you're, you know, I know the circle of influence around you is additionally very heavily focused on positive reinforcement, and you're the kind of veterinarian sport medicine professional that goes to Clicker Expo and hangs out with all of us geeks. For someone else in your shoe going through your the things you just described, but maybe not within that bubble as much as you might be, are they also being exposed to the same kind of content that you are, being a Clicker Expo attendee and having that circle of influence so close to you?
Yeah, not as much as I would like. I would like it to be more heavily focused on. Right now, it is more about procedures and tools of the trade and how those tools work. Like, you know, we learn a lot about ultrasound and therapeutic laser and how they work and how they help and how to apply them. And very little, I would say, on actually therapeutic exercise and how to approach patients, how to keep them happy, how to have them wanting to be involved in the therapy. I think really right now that's individual pursuits. You have to be passionate about it and go out and find your own way to discover that. And I wish there was more. I wish, you know, all of us went to Clicker Expo and, you know, wanted to learn more about the behavior aspect in all of veterinary medicine, not just rehab and sports medicine.
Yeah, and I think people listen to this podcast do as well, and also at the same time acknowledge and appreciate that everyone's a subject matter in their own special area. So we're grateful that we can go to someone that knows about ultrasounds, because we, as pet professional trainers or zoo trainers or whatever industry we're working on, horse trainers, don't have that knowledge. And we don't really want to get it. So we're super grateful that all of that stuff's happening, and we can go to people, even if their resources don't allow them always to go to Clicker Expo and everything. But at the same time, it's a catch-22, isn't it? Because we want everyone to go there. Looking at the time, I've asked too many questions already. So let's just, before we go on to the next topic that we wanted to talk about today, can you just let everyone listening know where they can go online specifically, or if you're in Seattle or the surrounding area more in person, where they can go to find out more about you and get in touch?
Yeah. So I currently work at Sound Veterinary Rehab Center. It's in Shoreline, Washington, which is just north of Seattle, but basically Seattle. The website for that is soundvetrehab.com. And that's really for all my clinic stuff. So if you need to see me in person, that's where to go. For myself, I also teach online through Fenzi Dog Sports Academy and Camthor Canine, and do online consults and online coaching for canine fitness as well. And you can find that information on the Total Canine, and canine is spelled out CANINE.net. And you can also find me on Facebook as well under the Total Canine.
Cool. And we'll make sure to link all of that in the show notes for everyone as well. What specific courses are you teaching on Fenzi?
So on Fenzi, I have taught jumping gymnastics with Sarah Strumming. That was the first course that I started teaching there. And then since introducing that, I've also got a fitness with Cavalettis class and a fitness with platforms. So specific fitness classes only using that equipment. And then my current class right now is called Anatomy of a Workout. And it's more of a concept class for people to learn all the tools that they need to create an exercise plan for their dog.
Cool. I'm glad we asked that. We recently had your neighbor, Laurie Stevens, on the show. And we haven't dived significantly deep into fitness within ATA. We have, but having created some content on it recently, I realized how much the audience of ATA are wanting to learn more about this area of animal care and management. So hopefully, I feel quite confident that people in the ATA podcast audience are going to be excited about learning new opportunities for some of the stuff you just mentioned via Fenzi Dog Sports. So as mentioned, we'll link all of that in the show notes. We will move on though. Thanks for sharing everything so far, Leslie. We love hearing about people's behavioral odysseys, as we call them here on the podcast show. But now I want to talk some more about exercise. I feel most people who listen to the show, including myself, will think they have a good exercise plan for the dog. And we take them on regular walks, we take them through different terrains, excuse me, and maybe have dabbled in various fitness training at home. However, I can acknowledge that this is very different than an actual strategic exercise plan. Something that's important if we're doing sports with our dogs, but also for the average pet dog, just as it is for our own health, I'm assuming. We're gonna get you to tell me if I'm correct or not. Can you please talk to this for us, Leslie, and in your much more knowledgeable and I'm certain articulated way, tell us the importance of an exercise plan for both dog sport people and your average dog owner.
Yeah, well, you are correct, Ryan. So we know exercise is important to our health, and I think we can extrapolate from that that it's also going to be true for our dogs as well. We do know from the Purina Lifetime Study that dogs that are a healthy weight live significantly longer than dogs that are overweight. And even though that specifically had to do with weight, I think we can, again, kind of extrapolate from that probably the dogs that were a better weight were more fit than the dogs that were overweight. So in people, I just thought, you know, it'd be good to kind of go through some of the health benefits from exercise, because I think that's where, especially with pet dogs, it can sometimes be hard to get ourselves to exercise. So then you ask them to exercise their dogs and they're like, I don't have time for that. So again, being a positive reinforcement person, I want to let them know, hey, here are all the health benefits of exercising regularly and having a fitness routine. And so some of them I think are pretty obvious, but it's always good to do a little reminder, you know. So exercise, obviously, it improves cardiovascular health. It reduces weight. It's going to lower your blood pressure. It's going to increase muscle strength, improve sleep quality. And then this is the really important part that I think for my job is it improves mood and it manages pain through endorphin releases. It also can sharpen the mind through secretion of a hormone-like substance called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And it's associated with lower levels of inflammation. So the thing I always like to remind people is fat is inflammatory. So the less fat we have on our bodies, the less inflammation we're going to have. So for pet dogs, you know, really what I'm looking at is, you know, talking to people about how they will be healthier, they will live longer, you'll spend less on vet bills if you get them out and exercise. It's hard, you know, time is always a huge factor. And so, you know, we have to realize that and help them figure out a better way to manage their time and get the exercise. And I always tell them, if you can at least get a walk, that makes me happy. So, you know, if you're walking your dog every day, yay, I'm really happy about that. Living where I do in Seattle, convincing people to walk their dog every day is fairly difficult for about 9 months of the year because they don't want to walk in the rain. So we have to come up with something else. For sports dogs, the exercise plans, not only do they do all those things that I just mentioned, but I think really talking to them about two factors. It's going to help prevent injury, and it's also going to improve their performance. So if they're looking at like an agility, you know, increasing speed on the course or knocking less bars, not knocking any bars, I think a lot of times an exercise or fitness plan can really help them achieve that.
Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Did I get that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought like that was really cool. And that's, I I'm really excited about that. So that's why in people, it has to do with exercise to help cognition and prevent things like dementia and, you know, aging problems with the brain. So it's really interesting. I'm like, oh, could exercise actually help our dogs learn better? So,
right. So when our dogs exercise, the working of the muscles helps the brain release this chemical?
The muscles actually release this chemical.
And that then influences the brain? Brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It's confusing because yes. It says it's derived from the brain.
Right.
But it's not. What does that mean?
That's a great question. I don't know. I don't know why it's named that. But it was actually, it's the skeletal muscle that releases or secretes the hormone.
So I don't think anyone can argue with the benefits. It improves cardiovascular health, lowers blood pressure, improves muscle strength, improves sleep, improves mood. And you mentioned in Seattle there, it's pretty cold throughout the year and you're trying to motivate. Because additionally, for people doing consults with pet dog owners, you know, giving them enrichment and making sure that their daily routine facilitates the setting events for their dogs to be nice and calm around the home. Have you found that listing benefits motivates pet dog owners? And if so, if explaining the benefits helps them, does that maintain motivation over time? Like how do you set up a program for the owners to continue the exercise plan that you set for their dogs?
I think it can, if it motivates in the beginning. So I think the maintaining motivation is always the hard part. And I will say I have not figured that out yet. But definitely in the beginning, being able to list these benefits and talk to them about things like the Purina Lifetime Study really can start a motivation. The other thing is I'm also typically dealing with clients who are they're coming back from surgery or an injury. So they've already had something negative happen to their pet and they want to keep that from happening again. So they already have quite a bit of self-motivation. I definitely know I don't have the struggle of like going out and just dealing with pet dog owners that are, you know, maybe just coming to a training class and trying to convince them to exercise when there's nothing, you know, wrong with their dogs. So I do think that is a difficult hurdle, but I think the more we get information out there and talk to them about it and give them ways to make it easy, I think the more they'll do it, hopefully.
All right. So with these, I'm going to go walk through a number of avatars for you as when working with clients. So firstly, you've got your pet dog owner who isn't really into training or isn't into training at all and has very little time. Well, they want to dedicate very little of their time to this. Do you recommend to them other parts of a plan other than walking, or is the main focus just to get their dog out and active?
So what I try and do is I always try and get a sense of what their routine is and can I then build from their routine. So if they're not very motivated, they don't do a lot with their dogs, I want to know, okay, so what is your daily routine? Like, what do you do? You know, there has to be, you know, sometime that they take their dog out to go to the bathroom, hopefully. You know, there's little things that I can build off of. So say they're like, I don't do anything. I sit on the couch all day. We watch TV. I take Fluffy out 4 times a day. I stand on my deck and watch her pee and poop and then come back in. What I'm going to try to do is say, okay, so when you take Fluffy out, and you watch her go to the bathroom, now try and do a lap around the backyard. Just walk with her. Right there, she's getting more exercise than she typically does. You know, if you take that type of client and you say, okay, I want you to walk a mile every day, it's not going to happen. It's too big of a jump. It's, you have to split things just like with behaviors. You need to split it down to its smallest successful point and get them to do that. And then you can add on to it. So now maybe a week later, they've come back in and they've said, okay, every time I took Fluffy out, we did a lap around the backyard. So they're getting 4 laps a day. And after a week, I mean, maybe you get like 2 pounds of weight loss, or you can see a little more definition in her muscles. And you can use that as the next motivating factor of like, hey, all it took was this little change and we've already made significant progress. So now what can we do? How can we add on to that? Another thing I'll do, you know, if they tell me, oh, well, I always ask Fluffy to sit before I let her out the door, then I'm going to say, okay, well, rather than just asking for one sit, ask her to sit and then stand back up and sit again and stand back up. And maybe you do that 5 times before you let her out the door. And every single time you do that, now she's getting a little bit of sit to stand exercise and really working those back legs.
Yeah, cool. And when we caught up to discuss topics for this podcast episode, you mentioned that you wanted to talk about how we can use a lot of the behaviors average dog owners learn and turn these into exercises. So that was a great example there. Do you have any other examples of stuff average pet dog owners do and how we can turn those into exercises as well?
Yeah. So, I mean, I really, with the clients that I see, I'm mostly building off of behaviors that kind of the general person would have already taught their dog. So, you know, usually coming in, I would say the common behaviors we see are the dog can sit and it can lay down. And a lot of times we see a lot of like shake or wave or high five, whatever you want to call it. And so the easiest thing to do to start out with is adding repetitions to that behavior. So rather than just asking for one sit to get a reinforcement or to get let out the door or whatever it is, you know, ask them for multiple times. Same with lying down. Same with, you know, if they sit and shake, you know, make sure you're doing it with both paws, not just one all the time. And, you know, ask for 5 repetitions before they get that reinforcement. Then make it a little bit harder. See if they can actually shake shake while they're standing. Adding duration to behaviors also is exercise. So the longer a dog has to hold a stand, they're having to engage their stabilizer muscles, the longer holding a sit. The other thing you can do is if the dog already has some kind of stationing behavior. So they know to like go to a mat or go to their bed when, you know, something's happening, make that station something that's a little bit unstable. So they have to work a little bit harder. They have to engage more of their core stabilizer muscles to hang out on it. And then ask for your, you know, you can always ask for your positions on that unstable station as well. So asking them to hold a sit, even though it seems like it's just a sit, it's not that hard, it's actually amazing how when you ask a dog to sit on something unstable, even for 30 seconds, you can really start to see them have to engage their muscles. It's just like when we do a plank and, you know, you start out and you're like 10 seconds into the plank, you're like, oh, this is easy, no problem. And then you get 20 seconds in and you start shaking. And then at 30 seconds, you're like, I'm gonna die, I can't do this. And, you know, you just collapse. And, you know, you were just holding a position, but you were engaging muscles and working hard to do that. And we can do the same thing with dogs.
Yeah, that plank example is a good one. And might be shaking a little bit earlier than you suggest. But anyway, I'm sure that there were so many takeaways there for the people that are working with pet dog owners, but there's also people that listen to this podcast who have their peanut at home and their exercise equipment brought from Walmart or Kmart if you're here in Australasia. And they might be just getting into it though. You know, they've seen videos on Facebook and they've seen people using these and they kind of got their dog on them. But someone who's a little bit more into positive reinforcement dog training and is a little bit more motivated to and excited by trying new things, what are some suggestions you can make for someone just getting started into doing more exercise with their dogs?
Yeah. So if you're just getting started and you've got some of that instability equipment and more into specific fitness training, what I would suggest is definitely trying to find a class with someone that can teach you about proper form and posture when doing the exercises. So just like going to a personal fitness trainer, you know, for a human, we really need to focus on how the dog is moving, especially when we're introducing that instability equipment, because we don't want to create problems by encouraging improper movement. So I think that's really important. There are a couple dog fitness certifications out there that you can look for. Canine fitness trainer is one, and I'm fairly sure that one is available across the world, as well as there is one that you can do through Fenzi Dog Sports Academy. So that being online, anyone can do it and get certified. There are lots of online classes as well now with fitness training. So you can pretty much find one going on at any time.
So don't just buy stuff and do stuff because it can cause... Do you see that? Like, is that some of the clientele you get?
Yeah. So that equipment is not inherently safe. When I was working consulting with FitPaws, which is one of the manufacturers, you know, one of the things they always had us say was, you know, it's a tool, not a toy. You know, things can happen. It moves around, it moves different than the dog might be expecting it, and that, you know, injuries can happen. The other thing we're looking at, and again, this is really extrapolating from human fitness, but thinking about things like when you do a squat, when you're working out and you're doing a squat, you know, you want to be really careful of how your knees track over your toes during the movement. And while we don't have a lot of evidence, you know, to say that, oh, if you do it wrong in dogs, you are going to cause a problem. We don't want to reinforce bad movement or bad posture, because we do see in people that over time it does create problems, and we don't want those problems to happen in dogs.
And being someone who's run half a marathon once in my life in a very painful way because I injured myself quite badly training for it, seemingly having done the training wrong, I can definitely appreciate the importance of getting professional advice on that. Now, the next avatar I'm going to throw at you is the sport dog professional who has specific need above just the health benefits you mentioned with regards to competing, using that dog to compete in dog sports. How would a plan for these people differ from the plans that you've talked about so far?
Yeah, so usually for the sports dog people, they have the foundations, they have the exercises. They don't really need to be taught necessarily how to do the exercises. What they need is more of how to put it all together. So when they should be doing a lot of volume or really heavy strength training versus when they should be taking it easy in relationship to their competition schedule. So a lot of times, you know, there may be some work with teaching them new exercises that are specific for their sport. So I like to look at the different tasks required in their sport, the different movement required in their sport, and making sure that they are doing exercises that imitate that movement or task and really build the strength and, you know, help the body be able to take the impact of that sport. But then also it's a lot about scheduling. How many times a week should they be working out? When should they be working out the most? How many days should they rest before competition? You know, what if this is their big world championships? How much time should they take off? Or, you know, should they still be doing some exercises but focus on more flexibility and balance rather than really doing a lot of strength or cardiovascular training?
And are these dogs like humans? They're having a warm-up session and then they're doing more vigorous exercise and then they're doing a cool down session. And how important is that for all of the different people that we've just talked about, your average pet dog owner, your behavior nerd, and your sport dog professional?
Yeah, so I try, especially for the sport dogs people, to really build in warm-ups and cool downs to not just their workouts, their exercise, but also to their performance. So a lot of people who, you know, we'll use agility as an example. They compete in agility. They haven't really thought about, you know, warming up before the agility run. They just kind of, you know, get the dog out of the crate and walk it to the ring and then go compete. And so that is definitely part of the sports dog education process of making sure that's involved, especially for the injury prevention concept. For pet dogs, I will say I feel like the more in depth I get into that, sometimes, you know, their eyes start to glaze over. It's a little too much. And so in my head, you know, I will build the concept in, but I may not specifically talk to them a lot about, now you need to do this warm up before you do the exercise. So if we go back to Fluffy and doing her lap around the yard as her exercise, I'm going to say probably that time she spent sniffing to find just the right spot to go to the bathroom was her warm up, you know, from sitting on the couch doing nothing, that then, you know, she's warmed up enough that you can do a nice, easy stroll around the yard and you're not going to affect anything. And then because you didn't get super, you know, high intensity exercise from doing that lap around the yard, you don't really need much of a cool down, you know, probably just walking back to the couch is enough of a cool down for that.
And you said when we caught up to talk about this episode that you had some examples you might be able to share from us with regards to helping the audience of the show kind of understand how you approach a client that comes to you. And you were going to use the example of jumping in agility because that's a common challenge that people come to you with.
Yeah. So, well, it stems back from the fact that, you know, Sarah Strumming and I created the jumping gymnastics class that we do on Fenzi Dog Sports. So we've kind of earned that reputation of if jumping is an issue, take that class or contact them. And it originally comes from my own dog, Stig, who had a bit of a jumping issue when he actually landed in the middle of a jump, and it, you know, scared him pretty bad. And then he was like, now I'm going to jump everything much higher than I really should. And so we needed to come up with a solution. And so, you know, we looked at it both behaviorally and physically. And what really opened our eyes was how much we don't take into account the physical part of jumping. You know, we can teach them how to jump. And then once we teach them, we're like, okay, they should know how to do it. And they can compete in their sport. And a lot of dog sports have jumping in them. Agility is probably the biggest because it has so many jumps and jumps from all different approaches. So it is really hard for people to understand the physical aspect of how strong the dog needs to be able to do it appropriately. So one of the biggest things, you know, people come to us because they've gone to agility class and they've been told their dog doesn't have any drive. You know, it walks between the jumps. And a lot of times what we're finding, and this is multiple clients, I couldn't really come up with just like one because I was like, man, over and over again, this is the problem, that they're being told your dog doesn't have any drive. It's not motivated. And really what it is the dog's not strong enough to do the jumps. And so it doesn't want to do the jumps. And so we build a exercise program that combines specific exercises that break down the different parts of jumping. So the takeoff, the aerial, the landing, and strengthen those individually while also doing some cardiovascular plyometrics type exercise in the form of jump grids and, you know, single jump exercises.
So I'm sure when you just said the construct drive, then all of these sport dogs people's ears perked up. It's coming from in the area that's not dog sports related. My background, and then kind of communicating with and interacting with many dog sport professionals, but always coming in as a learner because I appreciate that that's where my position is in the sport. I hear the word drive a lot.
Yeah.
And you've just kind of suggested, hey, here's another lens to look at the same challenge. So what I'm going towards is someone might be listening to this podcast right now going, my dog lacks drive. Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe I need to come up with an exercise plan. Like, where is that, or how can you help people listen to the show identify if they're that person?
Yeah, that's a good question. So going back to drive, yeah, for me, it's a really vague concept. It's a very difficult concept to operationalize and know this is what you mean by it. And I always find like there's something else that is leaning towards it. You know, there's some cause usually, you know? And so for me and my side, my profession, I always am looking at the physical side. You know, is there the potential that something hurts? Is there, you know, how is their weight? You know, how is their strength? You know, is there a point if I lower the jump height where they can jump and they want to jump? And then as I raise it, suddenly they don't want to. You know, that tends to tell me it's probably more of a strength issue than just a and I don't even like to really use the word, but a drive issue. My first, again, putting my veterinary hat on, is if you're wondering if it's drive versus strength, you know, getting the dog physically examined. And this is where it gets hard because, you know, when you're looking at, sports, a lot of, you know, a dog can be a pet and, you know, have some pain and still look totally fine as a pet. But then you ask them to do something like jump and now you see an issue. And so a lot of times veterinarians aren't necessarily going to acknowledge that there's this subtle pain or chronic pain because it's really hard to identify because dogs can't tell us like, hey, yeah, it kind of bothers me. It kind of hurts when I jump, but I'm fine when I'm just walking around. And so it can be hard to pinpoint that it's a physical problem. And that's, again, trying to find like your rehab sports medicine vet. That's probably going to be your best bet for really investigating the dog and trying to determine if there's a physical problem versus a drive problem.
And you can't see Leslie's face, everyone. I can because we're using Zoom, but there was a bit of hesitation I saw in your face when you're using the word drive. Like any construct, I feel there is challenge and operationalize it as a personal opinion. And so two really helpful things you've just suggested there are get the dog physically examined and also test it. And you've got ways that you can kind of test certain aspects of a challenge that we might be labeling as drive. Is that an appropriate way of phrasing that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think of there's not like a standardized fitness test, but I think we all, as a sports medicine professional, kind of develop our own fitness test. So there are things that I will ask the dog to do and watch how they move, and that can help me identify if it's a physical problem. So, you know, I'm going to watch, you know, most dogs will sit when asked. And so I'm going to watch when the owner asks the dog to sit, how do they sit? How do they get up from the sit? You know, how do they walk and trot and run? Can I see any movement abnormalities during all these tests? And then I'll do other challenges. Like I'll ask them, or I'll do it where I hold up a leg and see, you know, how long can they maintain their balance, even though they only have three legs to stand on? And what happens if I, you know, do that with each of the legs? And then I'll ask it, you know, like I said, to jump and jump straight on at different heights and angles and wraps, you know, really try and pinpoint the exact issue with why they don't like jumping, you know, or why, you know, they're walking in between jumps or avoiding jumps or that kind of problem.
All right, so I've got off the couch and stopped watching Netflix and I've got Fluffy with me and I brought Fluffy to you and I said, look, I just need you to fix Fluffy. We have a drive problem. And that's all the information I give you. Do you then have, in your mind, do you know immediately what the next step is or what specific questions do you ask? And then going back to something you said, should there be a standardized fitness test, do you think?
Yeah. So with Fluffy and her drive, the next step is we're gonna spend a lot of time talking, because I'm gonna ask you, okay, what do you mean by that? What's, you know, describe this drive issue? What, you know, usually if someone says they have a drive issue, it's because the dog doesn't want to do something that the owner does want them to do, and so. It's going to be a lot of questions, a lot of talking, a lot of trying to really pinpoint what's going on. And it's not always physical. And I will say, you know, probably I'm not the first person that this person has brought Fluffy to, because they've probably gone to their dog trainer first, or, you know, someone else has told them your dog lacks drive, and they're probably going to try and investigate that with them first. And then they've probably been told, hopefully they've been told, maybe there's a physical issue. Now go see Leslie and make sure that there's not a physical issue causing this lack of drive. as for the fitness, like a standard fitness test, I don't think it has to be standardized across people. I think the standardization is really individual, that you use the same test so that you can really objectively compare, you know, before and after. There is some work to have kind of standardized strength tests in dogs and in like rehab and, you know, like certain benchmarks that the dogs have to hit to like know when to progress them. But it really has to do more with rehabbing from injury. Like, can the dog sit square? Okay, when I check that, when we meet that mark, now I can move them on to a different exercise versus, you know, fitness tests like people do where it's like, how many sit-ups can you do in a minute? Or how many push-ups can you do in a minute? Those are really meant to show the person that they've improved. It's like, okay, well, before we started our fitness program, you could only do 20 sit-ups in a minute. And now we've done 4 weeks of fitness and you can do 50 sit-ups in a minute. You've gotten better. So that's really what fitness tests in kind of exercise are for, I think.
Well, talking about spending a lot of time talking, it's definitely something that we've done in this podcast episode. So sadly, we are going to move to the final question. And for this one, Leslie, I'd like you to do the opposite of what you did at the start, rather than take us back. Take us now into the future and think about your career and what you do as a profession and then the greater positive reinforcement community as a whole. What do you really want to see happen and evolve over the next 5 to 10 years?
I'd really love to see veterinarians kind of embrace positive reinforcement training and more than that, like really look at fear-free or force-free, whatever term you want to use to explain it, kind of that kind of program in the veterinary clinic. Obviously, there are some times where you can't give the patient a choice. It's life or death and they have to do it. But, you know, being more willing to accept that some things aren't life or death and we want the patient to cooperate and be happy to come to the vet and see us. And then on top of that, getting more specific in the sports medicine realm, I really want to see us change how we think of these dogs that do work and do compete and recognize that they are athletes and we should treat them like athletes and prepare them for their sport in a similar manner to the way people prepare to compete in their sports.
And I was going to ask you this at the start, but I kind of thought that it would come up now. So I'm patting myself on the back. But the vet conversation, obviously, you know, we're so grateful to that industry. I mean, you know, the relationships we build with vets are so important and the work that vets do are so important. And we couldn't care for animals without vet care. We also, as you know, are supportive of force-free and fear-free and additionally acknowledge the huge pressures that are on veterinarian professionals. It's something we talk about in the show is unfortunately mental health's a big challenge there because there's so much pressure on vets. What is one idea maybe you have to kind of start? What is the next approximation? That's going to be my question. What is the next one small approximation we can take towards creating opportunities for these conversations?
Oh, wow. That's a really tough question. I think a lot of it is about showing what can be done, which I think is already happening. So rather than, you know, telling someone they're wrong and saying that's not the right way to do it, but getting out there and really just demonstrating it and showing like, okay, it is okay to do it this way and it can be successful. And I think the biggest thing that will achieve, or what I'm hopeful it will achieve, is just having happier clients and happier patients. And I think if we had a lot more happier clients and happier patients, our mental health would be better as well. So a lot of it is, you know, things that I try and do too. I try and get out, and when I'm asked to speak at big conferences for rehab and sports medicine, I always try and to make it some kind of behavior topic of how I can incorporate positive reinforcement or choice-based relationship into the clinic, and how it does work and how my clients are happy because we do it that way. I've had more clients tell me that they appreciate the fact that we're willing to take our time and allow the dog to acclimate and get comfortable and be happy about everything that we're doing, rather than just rush them through. And if I had one simple step that I would like tell all the veterinarians out there, is it is okay to use food.
Awesome. I think that was a really great answer. So for that and for everything else you've shared with us today, Leslie, thank you so much. This has been a ton of fun. Before we officially wrap up, though, we mentioned it earlier, but once again, can you just remind everyone where they can go to find you online and see your other resources and learning opportunities that you offer?
Yeah. So my website is www.thetotalcanine.net. I'm also on Facebook under The Total Canine as well. And then my online teaching currently is mostly through Fenzi Dog Sports Academy, although I do also have some classes through Camp Thor Canine.
Wonderful. And we will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes as well. As mentioned, this has been so much fun. I've learned a ton and look forward to continuing to learn more over the coming while. Leslie, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening today, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. It's really appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. It's been a pleasure. I had a lot of fun.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.